Hey there, this is Greg Bryant, host of Jazz After Hours on WBGO.
And I'm Nate Chenin, editorial director at WBGO. April is Jazz Appreciation Month.
Yes.
You probably know that. We thought that on this podcast, Jazz United, it would only be appropriate, as we talk about jazz appreciation, to show our appreciation for someone who has been in our ranks, someone who has made history, and done a lot of things that we, I think, take for granted. And I'm speaking of the WBGO pillar and the distinguished producer and writer and jazz historian, Bob Porter.
Just an amazing legacy as a member of this music. Produced hundreds of records, starting with his tenure at Prestige, Atlantic, Savoy reissues. His two Grammys were actually as a writer of liner notes, one for the complete Charlie Parker on Savoy and another for the Atlantic Records compilation dealing with blues and early rock and roll. Bob knows this music, and he was socialized in a take no prisoners, he doesn't suffer fools lightly type of way. And you really get that, you get that vibe in Soul Jazz, the book that's, I'd say, is recommended reading wherever you come from in this music, however you're socialized into it. Jazz in the Black Community, 1945 to 1975. Bob was there. He took notes and he has a lot to say about it. And I know he told you about it, Nate.
Yeah. You know, when I got to WBGO at the beginning of 2017, I knew how important Bob was to WBGO, you know, as one of the founding members, you know, really kind of a Mount Rushmore figure.
Yep.
When it comes to Newark Public Radio, someone who was on the air from day one. But I also knew that, you know, this guy and the legacy that he has, you know, I'll confess, I was a little intimidated because he puts off that air of the old school.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm talking about, Greg.
Exactly.
It's kind of like, don't come to me with no, you know,
no weak
no
sauce.
Flim flam.
Exactly.
You know, no weak sauce.
Exactly.
And I'll tell you, we actually thought for a few years that this interview had been lost in somewhere in the digital ether. We couldn't find it.
Wow.
And I'm so pleased to report that we just recently discovered this file. And so Jazz United felt like the right place to to air that and to celebrate it. So we're going to bring that to you right now. And you know Bob Porter from his voice on the air. You're going to hear a different side of him. And before we go there, I just need to make the point that Bob has always been passionate about WBGO and about supporting WBGO. And Greg, I know you have something to say on that point.
We're all in this together, my man. Absolutely. And folks, you need to understand, if you're new to our podcast, or if you've returned, we want to get you to consider a gift, a financial contribution to WBGO. You know, shows like this, the Checkout, Jazz Night in America, our 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week programs, they're all made possible by your financial support. You can give that securely online at wbgo.org/support. You can go right there, give your tax-deductible contribution to ensure that we continue to inspire and entertain as we go. But again, we want to be here for years and years to come, and we can only do that with your continued support. And when you make that donation, tell them Nate and Greg sent you, okay? Right on.
So I am here with the estimable and great Bob Porter to talk about his book, Soul Jazz.
subtitled Jazz in the Black Community, 1945 to 1975. So, Bob, thank you for being here to talk about your book. I wanted to start, first of all, by congratulating you on it, because it's a very illuminating read. It feels very much like sitting down with you and just kind of soaking up a lot of insight and information. But the first question I have for you pertains to sort of a larger thesis behind the book, and it has to do with this idea of addressing an imbalance of sorts. The way you put it is, and I'll quote here, "You can find contemporary jazz history texts with no mention of Buddy Johnson, Illinois Jacquet, Gene Ammons, or Donald Byrd, successful jazz musicians whose popularity drew largely from the black community. And this situation seems likely to continue. There is little variance in the telling of jazz history." And so really, you set out in the first pages of this book to say, you know, we are going to sort of redress an imbalance.
Well, we're going to approach things differently. Redressing the imbalance, that's not really up to me. That's up to the reader to find out whether or not he reads a Mark Ridley text, for example, and finds that what I'm talking about really isn't included. Or, you know, he goes to a jazz class. God knows there are jazz classes all over the place, and a lot of these artists aren't even addressed. Well, you know, make up your own mind. But at least my attempt here is to put the information out there.
Your point of view with this history is clear in, as I said, the subtitle, Jazz in the Black Community, 1945 to 1975. And I feel like that's a really helpful framework to, you know, introduce right in the title of the book, because this is a book about the way that music resonated in communities and with real listeners. Can you talk about how that differs from and why it might differ from the sort of accepted historical narrative or the sort of critical bias that we see?
I think for the most part, now I'm not 100% up to date on this. You probably know this better than me. But most of the jazz histories that I've read have been written by white people. And in large measure, white people, white critics, would go out to hear what was available to them. If you had a particular assignment, you know, you obviously went to do that. But if it was up to you to choose stuff to listen to, where would you go? And let's use New York as an example, because it's something that we both know. If you were looking to hear jazz in the 50s, if you were Ira Gittler, for example, who was making records with Prestige at the time, you'd go to Birdland. You might go to the Cafe Bohemia. You might go to Village Vanguard, places like this.
Right.
Chances are you didn't go to the Celebrity Club. Chances are you didn't go to the Baby Grand. Chances are you didn't go to Small's Paradise. I mean, above it, 110th Street was a big deal in the 30s. John Hammond certainly made it a big deal, because most of the great black swing musicians were discovered by him and promoted by him. An example of that is great black swing musicians in other towns who didn't get here were largely unknown.
Or in some cases, they pass through town and have a kind of star-making moment at a club in Harlem.
That was possible back in the day. I'm not so sure it's possible now, but back in the day. Certain critics, Hugh Panassier, Stanley Dance, for example, always picked up on the black side of things. And when they were here, that's where they went looking. Stanley's wife, Helen, was very much a part of that scene in the 30s, you know, making records for Master and Variety and working for Irving Mills. And I think between the two of them, they contributed a good deal of what we know. Now, Helen was Canadian, Stanley was a Brit, but they're examples of people who came here, heard what they wanted to hear, sought out what they couldn't find, and really wrote about it to an extent that a lot of the American critics didn't write about.
There's a certain kind of bias that you're describing, but some of it strikes me as structural in the sense that there were record labels that were set up expressly for this purpose. You write in the early chapters of the book about, you know, the so-called race records, which evolve into, you know, what we then know as rhythm and blues. Can you talk about the ways in which there were, in essence, almost two different recording industries, the way in which that was segregated at that time?
Well, for example, if you went into a record store in 1945 or 1946, you would see 78s in the classical area, complete with some albums, perhaps. You would see a hillbilly section, that's what it was known as in those years. Dance bands, for example, was a category that was in use at that time. But that was a reference to the Artie Shaw, Tommy Dorsey, Harry James kind of thing. And anything that wasn't religious music was lumped under race music. Most record stores in white communities wouldn't carry spirituals.
What then does that do for musicians, practically speaking, in terms of their careers? Because an interesting thing happens in this narrative, which is that musicians who are extremely successful and popular in their time, in some cases then sort of fade as that time passes because of the way that the sort of machinery of commemoration is different than the machinery of commerce.
Well, let's take, for example, Louis Jordan. There's no question at all but Louis Jordan was the biggest single artist of the 1940s. Now, Nat Cole may have been as big later on. Billy Eckstein had moments of great popularity. But Louis Jordan was a smash success. He was every bit as big as James Brown was in the 60s. He had six number one records in 1 year. We're talking about the race charts.
Right.
Let's start with Billboard magazine, because in a large measure, much of our perception is based on how they categorize stuff. Their charts, black music charts, are known as race charts. They changed them at one point, they went back to them, but there were still race records in the 40s. Rhythm and blues, the term that Jerry Wexler is generally considered to have coined, comes in the summer of 49. And that's a point where things start to change. Because if now the popular black music is called rhythm and blues, whether it is or not, mm-hmm. is kind of irrelevant. But whether it's designated as such means that if that's not what you're doing, then the chances are very good that your career may start to fade. Because less attention will be paid to it. You know, chances are your record sales are not going to survive. And that's exactly what happened to Jordan. He was on Decca for many, many years, I think 14 years total. But the last few years, he had no hits.
Right.
And they tried him on Aladdin, they tried him on RCA, they tried him on Mercury, still no hits. Now, he was still headlining at the Apollo in the late 50s. You know, when rhythm and blues had, in many respects, morphed into rock and roll. But that was the community.
Mm-hmm.
Who wrapped their arms around him forever.
Right.
The fringe audience, the white audience that was interested in the success of these black artists, long dropped off.
Buzz me, baby. You mean so awfully much to me.
I appreciate how often you sort of pause to take note of technological changes, industry changes, economic and socioeconomic changes. One example is the way in which the format for recordings was influenced and then subsequently influenced the production. I'm thinking about the way in which 45 records were sort of sealed as the industry standard effectively by the jukebox business.
Yes, very much so.
And this is really relevant to this, you know, this period in terms of who is popular and how this thing is moving.
The 45 was an invention of RCA Victor. It debuts in 1949. I don't know whether or not the 45 ever would have been discovered if Columbia hadn't come out in 1948 with the 33 RPM, what we refer to as LPs. Now, the original LPs were 10-inch, four tunes a side. RCA came out with a 45 single and a 45 EP, what they call extended play, which had two tunes on each side. But the jukebox operators, who had been using 78s for their jukebox, were limited to 48 sides. With the smaller 45, they could double in capacity. And that's what all of them instantly did. Now, it took a while for some labels to even start making 45s. Atlantic, which is an R&B powerhouse, didn't start until 1952, I believe. And as late as 1953, MGM had a series of race records that they were doing, which was 78 only. So it took a while for things to sort themselves out.
Today, I mean, there are digital-only releases, there are streaming-only releases, there are, you know, people who release things only on LP, and it's this weird sort of Wild West situation. And reading the section of Soul Jazz that deals with these various formats and how balkanized the whole thing was, it actually reminded me of our present moment.
I think there's a good parallel to be drawn there. I mean, in the early 50s, there was a lot of confusion because remember this, if 10-inch LPs were the rule, there were still 12-inch LPs mm-hmm. out there for classical music in large measure. But Norman Granz put his concerts out on 12-inch LPs beginning in 1953. And he recorded a whole series of jam sessions for 12-inch LPs, essentially one long jam per side. And that was picked up on by lots of people.
Norman Granz is a figure who pops up. He keeps popping up in this book.
Yeah.
You know, he has an influence that spans decades. His Jazz at the Philharmonic tours and recordings, you make clear how relevant they are to what we later, you know, come to know as soul jazz.
Well, I think that number one, the Jazz at the Philharmonic concert atmosphere from the beginning was competitive. If there were two trumpet players, if there were two saxophonists, for example, they were trying to outdo each other, not among the musicians on the stage, but with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
What we think of now as getting house. That was part of the job. You had to get a lot of applause. If you didn't get enough applause, Granz wouldn't hire you again next year.
Right.
You know, so it was things like that. And there were certain musicians, Flip Phillips being a primary example of this. He was on Jazz the Philharmonic for 11 consecutive years. And it's because he was popular with the audience. Would go into his honking thing and the place would go crazy. So in that sense, the audiences in black clubs, you had to get house there too. And there were a number of different ways to do it. But I'll give you an example. Right here in Newark, the corner of Williamson Halsey Street, used to have organ bars on each side of the street, the mm-hmm. Cadillac Club and the Key Club. Now, each of them had the same policy. No cover, no admission. You paid for what you drank. But if the band wasn't hitting, the band wasn't getting over, the band wasn't getting house inside the club, audience would leave and go across the street.
Right.
So it's the competitive atmosphere that fueled a lot of that. And that's the kind of thing you tended to see in black clubs, in the sense that black clubs wanted to see their musicians work. Not be nonchalant and not pay any attention to the people who are sitting at the bar digging them. They expected those artists to reach out and try to impress them. I'm not so sure that that was the case in other venues,
right?
In other white places.
The enthusiasm is very, very clearly expressed, but so is the sort of disapproval. So is that, you know, you really do have to bring it.
That point of view also transcended down from the years at Minton's and Monroe's Uptown House. when the beboppers were getting together, if they thought there was somebody who'd come on the bandstand who couldn't play what they wanted to play, they would try and freeze them out.
Right.
Play an ordinary tune in a difficult key, for example, or change keys on a guy while he was on the stand. Do whatever they could to kind of shame him off the bandstand.
Right.
It's a little different with the avant-garde guys. Once you were known to be somebody like that, it was assumed that you couldn't play what the people on the bandstand were playing, so they'd try and freeze you out that way. Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of musicians in here that are familiar and that, you know, any reasonably well-informed jazz fan would, you know, would recognize these names. And then there are some other figures in here who have become much more obscure. Who is the most sort of unjustly overlooked?
I think the guys that I profile, for example, guys who I actually worked with, mm-hmm. Gene Ammons, Illinois Jacquet, both of them. Illinois always had a white following. I can't really explain why it was, but he knew how to get over to white audiences as well as black audiences. He was one of the few guys who crossed over early. I think it had a lot to do with his RCA records in the late 40s. Black Velvet was a big hit for him. The fact that he knew how to play great melodies as well as do all the gymnastics that he used to do. Mm-hmm. He was also very much a mentor to me. So in doing this, he was one of the reasons I wanted to do this, because I felt his story had never really been adequately told.
Well, on to Gene Ammons, because you write about him as well with a lot of heart. And also acknowledgement of sort of the struggles that he had, putting that into context.
You know, there's an old expression among blues people. They say, if it wasn't for bad luck, he wouldn't have no luck at all.
Right.
Gene didn't have a lot of good luck in his career after a certain point. Early on, he was a tall, good-looking black guy, man. Women went crazy for Gene Ammons. And he could play these ballads which would make women just fall out, man. But he could also cook and swing. And he had one of the great individual tones that you will find. He's an example of somebody who profited from high fidelity. Mm-hmm. The ability to enhance a sound that was already big and make it bigger. If you listen to My Foolish Heart, which was a big hit for him in 1950 and one of the first records that was a hit for Chess Records, it's a beautiful ballad performance. Billie Holiday called it one of her favorite records. So somebody can do that, but can also sit back and blow More Moon with Woody Herman and battle Dexter Gordon on Blowing the Blues Away in the Eckstein Band. I mean, you're talking about a guy who had lots of ability in lots of different directions. But because his popularity tended to come from the black community, and he tended to play venues in the black community on his own, mm-hmm. I think less attention was paid to him than might have been the other way around. When he came back, for example, after coming out of prison in late 69, where did he play? He didn't play the Village Vanguard. He didn't play places like that. He played the Club Barrack, 132nd Lennox. Or he played Count Basie's place. He played the South Side of Chicago. Or he played the Mozambique in Detroit. You know, black clubs. Essentially, at that time, there was still a huge audience for jazz. That's a period of time that nobody ever writes about. I get into it briefly in the book when Frankie Crocker takes over WLIB and it becomes WBLS. and they talked about the black experience in sound. Now, this is pre-disco, say 71 to 74, mm-hmm. something like that. And this is a format that spread like wildfire across the country. You could hear it on big stations that were not necessarily jazz stations, where you could hear Earth, Wind & Fire and Aretha Franklin and Les McCann. Or you could hear James Brown, you could hear one of the Motown bands and Gene Ammons. I mean, it was mixed. The idea of jazz performances with a certain kind of feel would fit right in with this kind of programming.
There's this interesting period to think about, too, as you enter, you know, the very late 60s, early 70s. The conversation becomes all about what's happening with jazz rock and fusion. And, you know, there are these bands, you know, obviously like Mahavishnu Orchestra and Weather Report and Return to Forever, Miles Davis's bands. And a lot of the conversation remarks how much these bands are resonating with young white audiences. But meanwhile, you have someone like Cannonball Adderley, who is at a very, you know, high period of productivity, and he's not a part of that conversation for some reason. So can we talk about...
Sure.
The...
Cannonball's music was more essentially soulful.
Right.
What Miles was doing from Bitches Brew forward was essentially rock.
Right.
And there's a world of difference between the two of them.
So during the so-called fusion era, you know, the sort of heyday, yeah. Basically, like, let's just call it the 70s, why do you think all of this music that you could call fusion, if you wanted to, because it was jazz and, you know, soul or funk?
Well, jazz and something else.
Right.
Remember that you had Latin rhythms that would be involved, mm-hmm. but you also had technology stuff. You had synthesizers, you had... You know, faux strings, things like this. All kinds of different options available to a guy who's playing a solo.
Right. So why is, do we not talk as, you know, when I say we, I say sort of the historical record, the critical conversation, why is that not as much a part of the conversation as the jazz rock, you know, that side of the fusion equation?
Well, who's writing about it?
Yeah, so it goes back to that.
Yeah, it goes back to, if you were looking in the black community, you wouldn't hear people talking about the Mahavishnu Orchestra, mm-hmm. but you'd hear plenty of people talking about Cannonball Adderley. I mean, a lot of it has to do with attitudes. You know, and the Cannonball always worked his audience. Man, he stroked his audience like nobody's business. And he was wonderfully successful, and then Mercy, Mercy, Mercy took off. Man, that was a big deal for him. His career had kind of been in a slump for a while since the early 60s, which was another peak period for him. But once Mercy, Mercy, Mercy hit, man, he took a hold of that and he ran with it.
It's interesting, too, to think about musicians like Cannonball, and, you know, there are others that you write about who make that transition from what you might call a hard bop energy into something that's more explicitly soulful and groovy and, you know, in some cases, funky. You know, there were a lot of people who recorded for Blue Note in the 50s, you know, under the sort of Horace Silver... Art Blakey, Lou Donaldson, you know, coming out of a bebop idea and moving more towards what you might call, you know, more
soul
like
jazz.
Yeah, soul jazz or like an R&B yeah. beat. And so how do you track that shift? Do you feel like it's is there something inexorable about it? Does it feel like well, this is of course this is what happens, you know, following.
Well, with Horace, if you listen to the Blue Note stuff that was the original Messengers with Horace and Hank and KD and then the Preacher. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's as funky as you can get for 1954. I think the blues feeling in Horace Silver, he may have been Portuguese, but I mean, hell, he had blues feeling above and beyond a lot of people.
Right.
So I think it was natural for Horace. Lou was, you know, when I was writing about this, I talk about a gentleman named Ralph Weinberg in here. Ralph Weinberg was one of the chief providers of talent to what was known as the Chitlin Circuit mm-hmm. back in the day. And he had a very prosperous business that went for many years. He died in 1953. Lou Donaldson said, I went out on a Ralph Weinberg tour, you know, and he talked about working with Wynonie Harris.
Right.
You know, and he says, Wynonie was crazy on the bandstand, man. He'd find the biggest, blackest, fat woman in the audience. He'd run over and jump in her lap. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is this. He understood the process of getting over. You know, and if bebop wasn't doing it for him, as soon as people started requesting blues walk, he knew what to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the conga became part of his act, and later on the organ became part of his act. I think to a certain extent, Lou was simply a very good band leader. He understood how to present himself and his music in any context. And if one worked better for him with the audience, that's the way he went.
Right. Another person that you profile who appears on a bunch of, you know, more hard bopish dates and then, you know, and then moves forward is Grant Green. This is another person whose humanity you capture. You know, there's some difficult stuff in there. There's addiction and, you know, it seems like he was somebody who tested people's patience. But he's also in your, as you point out, he's also a kind of an amazing story of like sometimes it has a happy ending because he's not forgotten. In fact,
yes.
he's maybe yes. a bigger name now than he was, you know, at certain points during his career.
I think that you're very right about this. Grant's history is interesting. He comes from St. Louis. He got a lot of his chops together, a lot of his abilities from working with Jimmy Forrest in St. Louis. They were worked together. They recorded together with Jack McDuff. You know, when Grant came to New York, he came with Lou Donaldson's blessing. Lou had heard him in East St. Louis, and they got him to bring him to New York, got him with Alfred Lyons, start with Blue Note. Now, at the time, Grant was strung out, but he got worse when he got to New York. And he simply hit up Blue Note for money. You know, you go buy the record label, you get 50. You go buy the label, you get 20, whatever it is. And in adding it all up, they ended up using them on lots and lots of record dates. I think in many respects, to just try and get even with the guy. And they recorded him in contexts that are unbelievable. I mean, I was listening last night to My Favorite Things, which she made in 1965 with McCoy Tyner on piano and Elvin Jones on drums. Now, they don't do Coltrane's arrangement, but it's close in times, and Elvin's feeling is very close mm-hmm. in times. Thank you. that's something you wouldn't expect a guy who comes up with the organ trios to necessarily want to tackle. Grant Green was a musician with remarkable abilities. And ultimately, in 67, I guess it's 66, 67 that he cleans up, or maybe 67, 68. I remember when I first contacted him, he was somebody I wanted to sign to Prestige when I first started working there. And Weinstock and I talked about this a lot, because Weinstock had had his own experiences with junkies, and he was a little reluctant to take on somebody at that stage of the game. But when we spoke about Grant, and when we talked about Grant, we realized that he would be able to play with other people. One of the things you got to do when you're producing records, if you've got a guy coming in from out of town without a band, you've got to assemble a unit right. to play for him. And Grant was perfect for that. A few dates that I used him with Charles Kennard and Rusty Bryant, people like that, he just fit hand in glove with those guys. It's like he'd been playing with them all his life. So that's what I was looking to do with him. I was as surprised as anybody that the celebrity that came to him later on. I think I remember voting for him as a new star in one of the Downbeat polls one year. That shows you how far my memory of him goes back. And of course, I always loved the guys he was playing with too, and he seemed to work so well with that. But I think other people who may have been more oriented toward Kenny Burrell or Jimmy Rainey or Tal Farlow, people like that, perhaps didn't appreciate that thing as much. But when Grant died, it's a shame. He was sick at a time that he had a record that was just ready to break. That very last record that he did for Victor Umbelu, it was starting to get airplay. And it really started to get airplay. But then he took sick, and he couldn't tour behind it. You know, you expect once a guy dies that, yes, there's a six-week period of activity. People want to get all the records because they right. won't be able to see the guy again. But then gradually what happens is that usually it simply craters. And for many artists, there's almost nothing going on in terms of sales for a long time. But Blue Note had all kinds of stuff in the can.
Yeah.
They recorded faster than Grant Green, faster than they could release them. And once he passed, they discovered all these, I think there's like a dozen unreleased albums in the can. And the Japanese, who were always very hip on all Blue Note artists, regardless mm-hmm. of what kind of music they played,
right.
if they were on Blue Note, they were important. They found all this stuff and I think there were 9 new albums of Grant Green that were issued after his death. And after he hadn't been on Blue Note for a good decade or so. But that was the launching pad.
Right.
And that launched the rejuvenation of Blue Note here in 1984. So that Grant's celebrity increased multiple times during that era. But if you listen to Herb Ellis and Barney Kessel, even if you listen to Jimmy Rainey and Tal, in terms of sound, those pairs of artists had a very similar approach. It's tough to tell them apart. Grant Green, you could tell him in a hurricane.
Right.
He was so distinctive, that tone of his. That's what set him apart initially. I think in the long run, that's what makes him important to guitarists. It's just that sound.
Where do you see the soul jazz idea most encouragingly expressed today?
It's really not. I don't know that it's ever be possible to recapture it entirely. Remember, you're talking about a social situation,
sure,
too. You're talking about the civil rights era, wars, things like that, the kind of stuff that for much of America is not a part of their daily routine. They take so much for granted. Nowadays, it's simply about the music. If it's in the pocket, if it's got a good soul feeling. Look, you want to have a good soul jazz experience, go hear Lou Donaldson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he doesn't play as much as soul jazz as he used to, but he has an act that he has honed for God knows how many years. He's still selling the same jokes he told in 1986, for example. But the fact of the matter is this, you will have a good time.
Right.
When you go out to hear Lou.
This has been wonderful, and you know, the main thing is I think you capture this this era and this perspective really well.
Well, I think that there, you can't have one without the other to a certain extent. You can't have soul jazz without everything else that was going on around it.
Right.
I do make an exception with the city of New Orleans, because down there the musical culture is very, very different. You can play any kind of music you want in New Orleans, and God knows there's an opportunity to do that. But if you're a musician, you are expected to know Louis Armstrong's repertoire. You are expected to know the great hits of Alan Toussaint and Aaron Neville and people like that. That it's a part of your core, it's a part of your fabric.
Right.
Now, too many jazz musicians these days, to me, I think that jazz starts with Coltrane. And I think that that's a very sad mistake. I put the onus on a lot of the educators myself.
Mm-hmm.
If you're being taught jazz in the classroom and you don't know about Hot Lips Page, your education is lacking, period.
Right, right. Bob Porter, thank you.
Thank you, Nate.
And that was me and Bob Porter in 2017 in the studio that we fondly refer to as the Kidney at 54 Park Place in Newark.
Yeah.
And I think you can hear, you know, that we are coming at this music from different backgrounds, different levels of access, you know.
Sure.
It's amazing anytime you get a chance to talk to somebody who was there. And Greg, I wonder if there's anyone in particular from his discography that is a personal favorite of yours.
Oh man, Grant Green, but in a circuitous way, because Bob's relationship with Grant was as, let's get this hired gun to come in and make all of these records infinitely better. The one that I can point to that was really ear-catching and fiery for me has been reissued as Brothers Four. It's actually a Don Patterson record. Sonny Stitt is there, Billy James is there, but Grant Green is the show stealer. Hearing how you guys talked about Grant, Bob went even further into their working relationship, further than you'll even read about in soul jazz. And to hear that it's like Bob's mission to get Grant Green back into circulation, you know, after his imprisonment and after he had, you know, cleaned up his act, so to speak, was really eye-opening. I love a good Grant Green story. He's my dude, and I'm glad you guys went there.
Yeah, Bob is full of those stories. You know, Greg, you and I sometimes talk about how this music lives outside of discographies and histories, right?
Yeah.
I feel like on this show, we've touched on that a few times, that, you know, that the music flourishes in communities and in social spaces and in, you know, familial settings. And I really feel like this is the thing. If there's one top line message that I get from Bob's writing and really what Bob has to say about this music. That's kind of it, right? This notion of how the music finds traction with real people.
That's it.
And I think that maybe the most important word in the subtitle of this book, when he talks about jazz in the Black community, is community.
We're all in this together, my man. Absolutely. And folks, you need to understand, if you're new to our podcast, or if you've returned, we want to get you to consider a gift, a financial contribution to WBGO. You know, shows like this, The Checkout, Jazz Night in America, our 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week programs, they're all made possible by your financial support. You can give that securely online at wbgo.org/support. You can go right there, give your tax-deductible contribution to ensure that we continue to inspire and entertain as we go. But again, we want to be here for years and years to come, and we can only do that with your continued support. And when you make that donation, tell them Nate and Greg sent you, okay? wbgo.org/support. Go online there and give your financial contribution right on. So coming up next week on Jazz United, we've got something equally special. Our tribute to the great Hammond B3 organ. We're going to talk about a new release that's getting some serious shine from one of the kings, B3 master, Dr. Lonnie Smith. And we're going to shine the spotlight on a couple of newer practitioners of the Hammond organ as well. Make sure to be with us again. Jazz United is a product of WBGO. Yours truly, Greg Bryant, and our editorial director, Nate Chinin. Our producer today is our senior producer, Mr. Simon Rentner. Make sure to check him out on The Checkout. Again, you can subscribe to Jazz United on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or you can listen on our website, WBGO. We'll see you again real soon. Take care.